Tropical Sound Agency.
Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is a space to find info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. I'm Egberto Willis, and
this is Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, Move to Amend's National Director, and today I'm filling in for Laura Bonham. We've got a great show ahead, folks. We'll be taking a look into a chapter from United States history with a conversation about Revolutionary War veteran Daniel Shays and the Massachusetts farmers who led one of the first uprisings in the post-Revolutionary War period. The uprising is known as Shays Rebellion, and we'll be examining the historical myths and lessons from this moment that can inform our democracy movement. We've got a lot of history to talk about. But first, we'll go straight to the news from the movement to amend the Constitution in this week's report with Communications Coordinator Keon Bliss.
Howdy, folks. This is Keon Bliss, Communications Coordinator for Move to Amend, bringing you the Most of the Time weekly grassroots roundup, where we share the news and announcements from Move to Amend National Headquarters based here in Sacramento, California. Now that the fall election season is upon us, our Pledge to Amend campaign has been heating up. Our volunteers have been targeting candidates for federal, state, and local office to pledge to use their office to support the We the People Amendment. We've already received dozens of responses from candidates and incumbents across the country, and we still need your help. You can learn more about the 2016 Pledge to Amend campaign by visiting movetoamend.org/pledge-amend and by watching our June webinar, which can be found at www.movetoamend.org/toolkit/webinars. It's with great pleasure that we announce several new co-sponsors to House Joint Resolution 48, the We the People Amendment, introduced in the House of Representatives last April. A shout out to Reps John Conyers from Michigan, Beto O'Rourke from Texas, Mark DeSalner from California, and Ted Liu, also from California, for being our newest co-sponsors. Our 2016 goal is 25 co-sponsors for the We the People Amendment before the end of the year, and this brings our current total to 21. Other co-sponsors include Move to Amend champion Rick Nolan of Minnesota, Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania, Jared Huffman from California, Keith Ellison, also from Minnesota, Raul Grijalva of Arizona, Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, and Peter DeFazio, also of Oregon, Louise Slaughter of New York, Betty McCollum of Minnesota, Mark Decano of California, and Barbara Lee of California, Danny Davis of Illinois, Walter Jones of North Carolina, and our first Republican co-sponsor, Earl Perlmutter of Oregon, Marcy Kaptur of Ohio, and Jim McDermott of Washington. Our thanks go out to all the citizen lobbyists and Move to Amend affiliates who scheduled in-person meetings and made phone calls with their representatives as part of our We the People Lobby Week. If you have a House representative that's not on the list, go to movetoamend.org/pledge-amend and follow the link to send them a message or call their office directly and tell them to co-sponsor House Joint Resolution 48. Move to Amend affiliates have already done great work to lobby and sway these courageous House members to step forward, so don't let your representatives off the hook. Let them know today that we want to see their name on House Joint Resolution 48, the We the People Amendment. Move to Amend is currently barnstorming across Washington State this August 24th through the 31st, and we're coming to a town near you. Our outreach director, David Cobb, and national team member, Ruthie Engelke, are spreading the word about the American creation myth and helping folks understand how they can work to abolish corporate constitutional rights and establish a government of, by, and for the people, not corporate interests. For information on dates and locations, check out our website for details at movetoamend.org/Washington. If you happen to live elsewhere and want to bring a Move to Amend speaker to your town, please email us at barnstorming@movetoamend.org to get started. Proposition 59, the Overturned Citizens United Act, is back on the California ballot this November after more than 2 years of campaigning. The Overturned Citizens United Act, which says that corporations are not people and that money is not speech, has been a long time coming, as our initial coalition succeeded in getting the measure passed through the state legislature in 2014, only to have the California Supreme Court take that away from us by removing the original measure from the 2014 ballot at the request of a private nonprofit corporation. But in the end, the court decided that the citizens of California do have the right to vote to amend, and we reorganized to get it passed through the state legislature once more to put it on the ballot this November. Move to Amend affiliates in California are actively campaigning to get out the vote between now and November, and we're calling on California volunteers interested in helping. If you live in California and would like to help spread the word about Prop 59, you can find additional details and contact information for local groups nearest you by visiting movetoamend.org/California. Also, keep an eye out. We'll be putting up a Vote Yes on Prop 59 campaign page where you can get materials and talking points so that you can help spread the words to your friends, family, neighbors, and representatives. Congratulations to Move to Amend volunteers in Shaker Heights, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio, for collecting enough signatures to put Move to Amend resolutions on the ballot in both cities this November. If you live in Ohio and want to get involved in these campaigns, you can find more information at movetoamend.org/Ohio. Each year, educational institutions which receive federal funding must provide programming on the U.S. Constitution around September 17th, which is Constitution Day. This provides Move to Amend an opportunity to get into schools and make connections with educators, administrators, and students. We are encouraging Move to Amend volunteers to reach out to their local schools in order to provide curriculum materials or extend the offer to present these materials in the classroom directly. Do you have a particular connection with a professor? Are you engaged with a faculty member or administrator in this conversation about current events, social justice, politics, or history? Many acquaintances we make in educational settings offer the opportunity to build a connection. All we need to do is ask. To find out more, go to movetoamend.org/constitution-day-2016. That's it for this week's report. If you'd like more information or would like to speak with someone on our team at the Move to Amend National Headquarters, feel free to drop us a line anytime at info@movetoamend.org or call us Monday through Thursday at 916-318-8040. This has been Keon Bliss filling in for Caitlin on the weekly Grassroots Roundup. I'm signing off. You can expect Caitlin again real soon.
Coming up next, we have a conversation with People's historian and author Ray Rafael about the history and myths surrounding Shay's Rebellion and its lessons for our own democracy movement. We'll get the ball rolling after a quick public service announcement.
To learn more about corporate personhood, money as protected political speech, and how to get involved with Move to Amend, visit movetoamend.org. Don't forget to sign the petition and join over 400,000 people supporting the We the People Amendment at movetoamend.org/motion. You can also text the word sign to 707-656-4019.
Move to Amend's We the People Amendment is the only proposed amendment in Congress that addresses both Supreme Court-created doctrines, corporate personhood, and money as speech, the very foundations of corporate rule. Passing the We the People Amendment is the necessary first step in transforming our democracy to one that truly represents the 99%. Go to movetoamend.org/amendment. Read it and take action today.
You're listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we bring you the voices from the movement to amend the Constitution and abolish corporate rule.
In the post-revolutionary years following the creation of the United States, a group of Massachusetts farmers led by former Continental Army Captain Daniel Shays took action on August 29, 1786, against the Massachusetts government for a slew of grievances, including seizure of farms and imprisoning farmers who couldn't afford to pay their debts. The uprising, known as Shays' Rebellion, only lasted a year, but it changed the course of U.S. democracy. Today, we'll be examining this chapter of early U.S. history, often overlooked, with author and people's historian Ray Raphael. Over the last decade, Ray Raphael has emerged as one of our leading writers on the birth of the United States. In 2001, his acclaimed People's History of the American Revolution widened history's lens to include those not generally present in tales of our nation's founding. In 2004, Founding Myths, Stories That Hide Our Patriotic Past, established new standards for future renderings of our nation's birth. In 2009, he incorporated his work into an original synthesis featuring seven diverse characters. The book is called Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. And in 2011, he was asked to create another broad synthesis for a different audience, and that was The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Founding Fathers and the Birth of Our Nation. Recently, he was focused on the historical context of the Constitution, and that book is called Mr. President, How and Why the Founders Created a Chief Executive, and was published in 2012. And Constitutional Myths, What We Got Wrong, What We Get Wrong, and How to Get It Right was released in 2013. Welcome back to the show, Ray. It's great to have you here.
Good to be talking with Move to Amend.
Great, Ray. It's great to have you here as usual. I think you can be now considered a regular on our show.
That pleases me greatly. Call me anytime.
Absolutely. Anyhow, look, it's really a pleasure to have you with us. Knowing the buried history, the truth behind U.S. creation myths impacts how we organize today for future generations of Americans. So I've really been looking forward to this conversation. What led you to take up the study of U.S. creation, debunking the myths around it, and why is it relative, especially today?
Actually, we go back now to the early 1990s, so about 25 years, and I was teaching a American history curriculum, and I, in a kind of revolt against the textbooks, and I decided to investigate a way to give a multi-perspective historical narrative. See, when the problem with textbooks, one, of course, is what message they give, but even beyond that, it's that they give a message. That it's a single narrative. You know, they digest and homogenize the narrative, and then they tell it to you, and you're supposed to learn it. And so I tried to create a multi-perspective narrative. And in doing so, I started with the American Revolution, and as a kind of a sample. And once I was there, I was trapped within the late 18th century and never returned. This happens to many scholars who are American Revolution and founding era scholars, is we get there, and then once we're there, it's so fascinating, we never move beyond. So today, I live half my life in 21st century America and the other half in late 18th century America. So that's what got me into it. And then from there, one thing led to another, and in terms of it, I realized that by studying the history and talking about the history of our founding, we have this kind of mythology in our culture that's all about the framers and the founders and all the wise people, and we're only trying to live up to their great wisdom. And there's kind of just anything you say about that era is taken to have contemporary implications for us today. So I realized there's two aspects to this thing. One is telling real history, really as it was at the time from that perspective. And the other is kind of an act of interpretation, showing people that that's what happened then, and times were different then, and how does that relate to us or not relate to us today? Those are the big questions, and there seems to always be a big audience that is interested in reading about that and addressing those questions. So basically, I'm a historian who practices very serious historical research, but I do it in a way that I think has relevance to today because of the way that our culture venerates the founders.
Do you find that in general, history as learned in the United States, and the reason I'm saying as learned in the United States is that being someone from another part of this world, the history is quite different than what we see here. Now, how do you feel about how history is revealed to the average American student, let's say starting from not high school, but actually from the time they hit kindergarten, first grade, second grade, etc.
Well, history here, and I'm not sure this is totally different from other places, because I really haven't, you know, I don't come from another part of this world, and I haven't studied another part of this world, so all I really have is here. But here, history, particularly the history of the founding era, is combined with this sort of nationalism, this kind of American exceptionalism, and, you know, we are number one, and this is the way we do it, and we do it better here. And the reason we do it better here is because we have these great founders, and they created a great nation. And there's this kind of and as I say, we're not the only nation who sort of, you know, self-promotes through history. As an American, I see that, and as a historian, I object to it. And also, as an American, I object to it. As a person who's alive on Earth and is looking at the big picture, I want to know the big picture. I want to know how this country relates to other countries. I want to know the full thing. I don't like to be told what to think, what to believe, what history was. I want to discover it. That's how why I became a historian.
I think that is great. You know, when one looks at your books or books from, let's say, Zinn, People's History of the United States, I think it gives, and the reason I asked the question I did before in the form that I asked it before is I think people like yourself and Zinn, they actually take that nativism out of it and try to be a bit more objective, which I think is rather important if we're to be taken seriously, not only by sensible folks here, but sensible folks abroad. Your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, native, we're surprised. We always seem surprised by the amazing outpouring of, you know, basically national chauvinism today, and, you know, with the Trump campaign. But it's been there all along. I mean, it just, you know, Father McLaughlin in the 30s and before that, and even Williams Jennings Bryan, although a populist, was terribly, you know, terrible nativist. So, and the American Soil Party in the 50s, I mean, it goes back. There's always been this current and a fairly ugly current of nativism. And the textbooks, you know, are not nearly so blatant, but there is an implicit message there. And since most people learn their American history, particularly their founding era history, in grade school at a very simplified level, it kind of permeates. It permeates our culture. And, you know, I think there's always been about maybe 30 or 40% of Americans that have been rather extreme nativists. So, you know, it's resurfacing today. And I think it will be, I feel confident that it's not the majority of Americans. I feel some degree of hope. But on the other hand, that's part of who we are as a nation, is somewhat protective and feeling entitled, and a kind of entitlement to some kind of mythical past that we own and other people do not. That's one aspect of our nation, but I think a more dominant aspect of our nation, and I think we're seeing this with Khazir Khan's demolishing of Trump, we are seeing this as that's going to be the dominant trend, is that we are going to once again not suppress that, but keep it from dominating and directing the country.
Well, I definitely want to get into talking about the current populist skewed situation, but we also wanted to focus on Shay in particular, Shay's Rebellion. And one of the things that I really like about your work, Ray, is that it helps tell the story of the other people who were not really included in our founding fathers, who actually shaped the country just as much, if not more so, in terms of some of those quote-unquote fathers responding to the greater public and some of these more nameless folks. In this August, 230 years ago, Shay's Rebellion started and ended about a year later. We actually do learn about Shay. I remember that we had, you know, maybe it was like one of those little pop-out parts of my history textbook in high school.
That's right, it always
like,
is.
Yep. Little... Uh-huh. Yep. Mm-hmm. Side story on Shay's Rebellion. So it's not exactly a buried history, but it's certainly a skimmed over history. So let's turn to Shay's rebellion. I think actually the kind of the populism that we're seeing in this election and the anger on the part of the American public right now makes it worth examining this rebellion. And what's the story behind it, if you could tell us in a nutshell?
First of all, it's going to be a little bit more than a nutshell, because what we the general perception of Shay's rebellion is very skewed. And so let me start at the outset by the name, Shay's Rebellion. And you say it started in August of 1786. Well, Daniel Shays was not involved in the beginning of the outbreak. He was not even a factor. He wasn't even involved. But we call it Shay's Rebellion. Why do we do this? Why do we single out one leader and one of several leaders, and a leader who came on board midstream and who was only kind of the leader of more or less the military aspect of it, and not the leader of the political aspect of it, and not involved in the whole build up to so-called Shay's Rebellion? Why do we single out one leader? And one reason I think we single it out is because then it's sort of like, well, there's one charismatic guy and a bunch of people followed him, so that's a way of kind of dismissing the actual demands of these people and what was actually happening and what was wrong with society at the time that generated it. So at the very start, I want to refer to it not as Shay's Rebellion, but as the Massachusetts Regulation of 1786, because that's the way it was seen at the time by the people who were in it, not the people who were trying to be dismissive of it, who just singled out a leader and called it Shay's Rebellion. Oh, in the textbooks too, they call it, they're Shaysites, and as if Shays was like a, you know, a cult leader, Shaysites, you know, just following along. and I mean, it's just so ludicrous. So now back to the initial story. Another thing that's never told in the books is the precedent for Shay's Rebellion. Now, we are talking in August, September, and October of 1786. Now, 12 years before, literally to the day, because these things are focused on court closures. That's the main thing that they did in the regulation movement. By the way, regulation, when I say the regulators, this was a term that other populist movements used at that time. And regulation means the people have to regulate their government because the government needs regulation. It's a very different, you know, now we think of government regulations. This was the reverse. The people have to regulate their out-of-control government. So the populist movements were called regulators. They called themselves regulators. So anyway, now go backward to 12 years to 1774. And in Massachusetts, so we are now before the Revolution, immediately before the Revolution, and in response to the Boston Tea Party, the Parliament has shut down the port of Boston, but more importantly, it has revoked the Constitution of the people of Massachusetts, their charter of 1691. It's revoked it. It's disenfranchised the populace. They no longer can meet in their town meetings. They have no say in the council, which basically rules the upper house of the legislature and the executive arm of the government, and basically has command of the province. And they have no say in their sheriffs, their jurors, all this stuff. It's just basically they're disenfranchised, and they rise up as a body and say, no way. So before Lexington and Concord, the people gather in every county court when that court is supposed to meet. And the county courts are the outposts of British imperial authority. And they're not only courts, but they're the executive arms of local government. So they are the government. They are the government in their counties. And people gather in every county in Massachusetts except Boston, because the British troops are there. And they shut down the courts, like in the town of Worcester, 4,622 militiamen organized in their 37 militia units from their towns line both sides of Main Street and have the British-appointed court officials walk the gauntlet between them, hats in hand, reciting their recantations and denouncing this unconstitutional act of Parliament and saying they will do nothing to implement it. this happening all over Massachusetts, and it's great outpouring of the people. Like that number, that outpouring in Worcester, that's half the adult male population of the entire county is gathering to do this. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because 12 years later, when there's a very different sort of unrest in Massachusetts among Massachusetts hinterlands, which is, you know, basically farmers, they look back on this and they say, what did we do back then? Oh, my gosh, we gathered together and we closed the courts and we basically said no way and the government cannot oppress us. And so that was so they're modeling this thing on this very successful revolution. And ironically, this successful revolution has been lost to history. We don't say anything about it. It's the greatest populist, the 1774 version, the greatest populist movement in the history of the nation.
Isn't it crazy that a democracy?
I know. It's totally crazy.
wouldn't want to tell that story.
This? And that's a whole other reason we can get into later, maybe if you want to, why we forgot this. But the reason I'm mentioning it now is for two things. One is to show how skewed the telling of history can be, that you forget the greatest populist movement in history. When I say greatest, I mean the largest percentage of the population at the time being involved in it, being absolutely peaceful. Not one life was lost. It was forceful, but peaceful. In other words, the reason there was no lives lost is because who dared object? You know, the 25 court officials faced with 4,622 militiamen. No lives are going to be lost. Yeah, what's anybody going to do? And so it's the most broadly based, and it's the most successful because it works, and it overthrew British authority. And that's why, you know, the following spring, the British march on the Massachusetts countryside that they had already lost. That was a counter-revolution. Lexington and Concord was a counter-revolution trying to take back a lost province. But these people now in Massachusetts, many of these people had participated in that. And now they're very upset, not with the British authorities, but they have very different sets of grievances. And they're kind of overlapping. But the two general things is they call it a debtor's issue. But that kind of a little bit cheapens it, I think. You look at the picture, and the revolution involved a great deal of debt because people had the governments really had no, you know, they couldn't afford it. So they had government bonds, and then those bonds after revolution had to be paid off. So the states are in debt, and the states are taxing people rather heavily to pay off those debts. So by the people, primarily that's the farmers, because the main tax is a property tax on property and on farms, on land. Meanwhile, the people who are getting taxed are looking at the wealthy merchants on the seaboard, and they're not getting particularly taxed, you know, because they're taxing property and not you know, commercial activity. So there's kind of a regional aspect to this too, and then farmers are there's kind of a post-war recession, so money gets scarce, and at the same time, British merchants are demanding payment in specie. So then the states are demanding their taxes in specie, and creditors in this, you know, the merchants who are selling things, the local merchants are demanding the farmers instead of trade, you know, pay their debts in specie. So there's a huge crunch here, and people are getting taken to court, and great numbers of people are losing their if not their land, portions. You know, you wouldn't necessarily use your whole land, but they would just take some of your belongings, you know, in payment. But they're being hauled into court, and so, needless to say, we can see why these disgruntled farmers are focusing on the courts, or on the local courts, to shut down those courts and stop these basically seizures of their property for debt. So there's been kind of waves of this happening in the 80s, and it just reaches a crescendo in 1786 in Massachusetts. Now, let me point out, we all talk about not only Shay's rebellion, but we think of it as a unique event, you know, a unique person, Shay's, but we think of it as a unique event, like it was just in Massachusetts. Not so. Things like this were happening all over in other states. There were other less widespread and developed, but certainly incipient revolutions, rebellions. Other courts were being closed. In Rhode Island, people basically succeeded at the ballot box and overturned a very conservative legislature and put in their own people and issued paper money, which really helps debtors and hurts creditors because that lowers the value of money and then the creditors don't get paid much back. So the creditors are very upset with paper money, and the creditors are very upset with the courts being closed in Massachusetts. And so, and this is becoming a national movement. And so, when the courts are being, let me just give you a physical dimension here. For a court to be closed, that means people are getting together and in a great body and going at the court and saying, okay, we physically won't let it happen. So they were doing this in all the same towns. In Worcester, for instance, they did it in 12 years almost to the day before they had done it before. They show up there. Now, meanwhile, there's one big difference between 1784 and 1786. In 1774 and 1786. In 1774, all the people, save for just a very thin veneer of rich office holders, were with the people. In 1786, you had more genuinely a kind of civil war. The debtors, but then there are also the creditors and also just people who are just a little bit more conservative and don't want to rock the boat as much. And so it's much more evenly split. So instead of several thousand people in Worcester, it's only, maybe it's several hundred. And it's kind of evenly split between the supporters of this rebellion and others, not quite evenly. There are more supporters. It is the dominant, the dominant thing. But it's more highly contested. There are two sides, and so people on the national scene are looking at this and saying, "Oh my gosh, look what's happening in Massachusetts. Several courts have been closed. It's beginning to happen elsewhere. We need to suppress this thing." So now how are these things normally suppressed? Well, first they try calling out the militia. But when they call out the militia, half the militia joins the rebellion. So so that's not going to work. So they say, okay, well, maybe we need to call out the army. Well, what army? We're in 1786. It's the Articles of Confederation. The army is just a few hundred people stationed in the West. And so they can't do anything. So they say, well, maybe Congress can form a new army. Well, how's Congress going to form a new army? Congress is dead broke. They have no way of collecting taxes because only the states can collect taxes, and then the states give some to the Congress basically begs the states for money. And in the 6 months before it led up to the Massachusetts regulation of 1786, the federal Congress, the United States, which was the United States, received a grand total of $663. That was their income. So now, how do you suppress a rebellion with $663? Of course, that's all they received, and a hand, like a couple of hundred soldiers, 1,000 miles away, obviously can't be done, and the militia didn't work. So any ideas, listeners? Think about it. What are they going to do? How are they going to suppress this rebellion?
I tell you, Ray, that's a good point for us to take a quick station break. So, folks, we'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
Does your elected representative support amending the U.S. Constitution to end corporate constitutional rights and get money out of politics? You can help us find out by joining Move to Amend's Pledge to Amend campaign. Help persuade local, state, and federal legislators to pledge support for our We the People Amendment. Recruit co-sponsors for this amendment in the U.S. House and Senate.
For more information, visit movetoamend.org/pledge-amend. That's movetoamend.org/pledge-amend.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
You're listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. And we're talking with author and people's historian Ray Raphael about the historical myths and lessons of Shay's Rebellion taking place 230 years ago or so this August. And Ray was about to tell us how the national government went about shutting down the rebellion.
Well, the national government couldn't because they had no money and they had no soldiers. And the militia didn't work, since half the militia joined the rebellion. So what happened is the rich people in Boston, the merchants, the creditors, who were being hurt by this rebellion, who were most threatened by the rebellion, they formed a private army. They hired people. And this private army was able to actually suppress the rebellion. But that's what it was, a private army. Yeah, of rich people. So this is what happens. It had come to that. Pretty sick, right? Okay, well, you know, we think it's pretty sick now, and people who might be sympathetic with the farmers think it's pretty sick that the rich people, you know, formed an army to suppress them. But the other people who thought it was pretty sick, I mean, the whole situation was pretty sick, was all these national leaders. People who were saying, who represented basically property classes, but they're looking at all these rebellions and they say, this is not working. The Articles of Confederation are not working. The whole thing is we are about to implode. This new nation is about to collapse. And so that is why, somewhat correctly, people see that the Massachusetts Regulation of 1786, which they dismissively call Shay's Rebellion, had a great impact in the formation of the Constitution. The Federal Convention, they call it the Federal Convention at that time, of 1787 really resulted from the great uproar of 1786. And so there's considerable truth in that. What the textbook version of it, though, saying, oh, it was just a reaction to Shay's Rebellion, is way too dismissive. It wasn't just a reaction to Shay's. It wasn't just a reaction to the Massachusetts Rebellion. It was a reaction to the whole collapse of the federal system, where the Congress did not have an army. The Congress could only raise $663 in 6 months. You know, the system, it was systemic collapse, and it led to kind of the Hobbesian war of all against all, and the extreme class warfare that was breaking out. So that's so in reaction, they formed the Constitutional Convention and created a much more robust federal government, a government which had the first and foremost the power to tax. And so then there would be money, and then they could have an army, and then the nation could continue. And
I just want to, because you got to you said the words that I was hearing of what was the real divide here, it was this class divide. And I also want to underscore, just because you know, these days we talk about it, we say rebellion, but I mean, what you were describing to me sounds like civil disobedience, where they were, you know, literally shutting down the places where decisions were being made that were harming the farmers.
It was stronger than civil disobedience because it was armed, and so. I mean,
so it wasn't nonviolent.
No, it was not. Well, see, now this is the thing. Okay. It was not nonviolent, and you know, shots were fired in the Massachusetts Regulation of 1786. There were actually kind of armies against each other, you know, particularly in Springfield, and then But earlier in 1774, there were no shots fired, because when you have, when 95% of the people are on one side and 5% on the other, shots don't get fired. The other guys just say, well, we lose, mm-hmm. But when it's contested, you see, and this is kind of a thing. You mentioned Howard Zinn. Now, one thing that Howard Zinn, people think of him as from his people's history and so on. But Howard, and I got very close with Howard in the years shortly before he died, after I wrote People's History. And Howard was an extreme pacifist, because he had been in World War II, and he had that on his conscience, the destruction that he personally had inflicted. And he was very, very strong pacifist. So he was fascinated by this Massachusetts Revolution of 1774, because no shots were fired, no blood was shed. And so he kept asking me, he says, Ray, can we do this now? Can there be, can't we have a revolution like this now, a nonviolent revolution? But I would point out to him that although no blood was shed, these were militiamen, and they were armed. And the reason no blood was shed is because they had the overwhelming support of the people. And so it wasn't a violent revolution, but it was still a forceful revolution.
And there was the threat. If they had needed to, they would have fired their guns.
Exactly. And so in 1786, the reason we call it Shay's Rebellion is because, as I say, he wasn't involved in the first aspects of it, the first closures. But when they started organizing more with arms to close the courts, Shays had military experience from the Revolution. He had been an officer in the Revolution, and so he was kind of recruited to lead the military aspect of this sweeping rebellion. One group of the military aspect. So that's how he came to be known as, Shay's Rebellion. But there was a military aspect to it. So you look at this whole thing, and what does this mean to us today? Because I'm sure that's kind of really where we're at. Like, what does it mean to us today? It's not quite civil disobedience, because it's more than that. It was a real rebellion. But you have to realize that, like, for instance, if you had that scale of rebellion today, if you wanted to avoid an amazingly destructive civil war, you would have to have an overwhelming majority of the people on your side. If it comes to that, I mean, if it comes to sort of a populist revolution of sort of people on the progressive side, well, do you think that that the other sort of self-proclaimed populists on the other side, the anti-government, pro-Second Amendment people who are very heavily armed, are going to sit by and let that happen? So you would have a very bloody sort of civil war. And the only way you can have a truly populist revolution is to really have the overwhelming majority on your side. And so that, and that's a big hurdle to clear today.
Although, interestingly enough, there are issues where we do have the overwhelming majority of people.
Exactly. Yes.
That's not necessarily what gets talked about in corporate media, are similarities, but...
Let's move to that, because that is exactly the place where there could be an overwhelming majority, because nobody's happy with Citizens United. On either side, by nobody I mean the populist revolution on the right is not as cognizant of it, but they certainly do not approve of money taking over politics. And so there is the grounds, if we can kind of break through the cultural barriers that are prohibiting those two populist movements from merging.
I think that comes from education, though, right, Ray? I mean, one of the things that I think has occurred over the last several decades is the diminishment of education in societies, which is one of the things that we do here at Move to Amend as well, which is at the same time that we're carrying the pellet, you know, the We the People Amendment, we're having programs like this where we try to enlighten folks as to what has happened before and also what, you know, what needs to occur. So I think that that plays a big role. And again, thank you for being here, sort of putting this story in the context of what can occur going forward. Now, before I ask this, because we're kind of coming down now at 34 minutes, as a historian who has spent a lifetime debunking creation myths in the U.S., can you provide some sort of clarity as far as the founders' positions on the rights of corporations, if they had any real positions on those?
Yeah, excellent question. First of all, what would be relevant to us wouldn't be really so much what the founders' positions were, but did they write anything into the Constitution? Because, you know, we are bound by the rule of law as determined by the Constitution. And what does the Constitution say about corporations? And it says absolutely nothing. It's not in there. Constitution is basically kind of about the where the federal government comes in and where the states come in and how that all works. And there's not a word about corporations within it. So there's nothing that binds us one way or the other. Now, you look culturally at the time, and people were very upset about monopolies. And they were really bothered. And the great monopoly that started the American Revolution really was the East India Company's monopoly on tea and the Tea Act. And the reason people were dumping tea into the harbor wasn't so much because of the tax on tea, because actually they lowered the tax, but was because it was a trick to dump monopolistic tea on the American market and undercut American merchants. So, you know, it was really, people did not like the East India Company, which was kind of a national, you know, very coordinated with the government, the national monopoly. Now, they didn't write this in the founders. Remember, the people who are creating the Constitution are a fairly conservative lot, and they did not write this anything about monopolies or corporations into the Constitution. But during the ratification debate, several states proposed amendments to the Constitution because they didn't want to just take this or nothing, as George Mason said at the convention. They wanted to have a say in it, and they proposed amendments. Now, the most famous amendments that they proposed turn into the Bill of Rights, but they proposed lots of other amendments. And two of particular note is at several state conventions, they proposed amending the Constitution to prohibit the federal government from establishing monopolies, okay? And the other one that was very interesting is they wanted to ensure the right of the people to instruct their representatives as to what to do. So the people, that would have been built in direct democracy, real democracy into our system, that the representatives would be doing the bidding of the people. Okay. Now, James Madison, when he is constructing the Bill of Rights, what would become the Bill of Rights in the first federal Congress, he leaves out these substantive amendments that were suggested by the states. For instance, the anti-monopoly amendment and the pro-instruction amendment, and just focuses on individual rights, what we call the Bill of Rights. So they don't get written into the Constitution, amended to the Constitution. But at the time they were popular. I mean, I think most of the people would have definitely supported a bill to ban the government from supporting monopolies. So it's kind of like the Constitution that wasn't.
Well, shocker, shocker that a wealthy man in the midst of a country that is experiencing extreme class divides leaves out, if he has the authority to do so, would choose to leave out the components that would allow for more economic democracy as our foundational law. Shocking, shocking.
Well, the other thing he was doing, you see, what these people, there was a movement to basically make the Constitution, yes, more democratic. And that what and he was and there was a lot of other amendments that he left out too. For instance, they wanted to put a stronger limits on federal taxation, but he the and it was kind of very purposive because there was a movement afoot to have a second national convention to recommend, you know, that would like propose, you know, look at all the state amendments and then propose federal amendments. According to the Constitution, you know, because there was an amendment process. And one, if you look at your Constitution, there are two ways that amendments can be initiated. One is by the majority, a supermajority of state conventions can propose it, and the other is Congress. Now, in order to avoid state conventions proposing these more radical amendments, Congress did a swift political move, and he said, well, the Congress can act more quickly, and he basically preempted the movement for more serious amendments by proposing them in Congress, and Congress was composed by Federalists and much more conservative lot than the population at large. So yeah, it is rather shocking, but it's what we have. Now, what we have, where instead of being anti-monopoly and having it written in, the Constitution is just silent about it. And I think we need to quickly move forward close to a century to the Civil War amendments and Amendment 14 and corporate personhood and all that kind of stuff, because it's ironic that the people who call themselves originalists and talk about original intent, that they somehow think that the original intent of the people who created the 14th Amendment were talking about corporations rather than Black Reconstruction. It's the most hypocritical jurisprudence that you can imagine. That people don't realize that people who are originalists and say, oh, we have to stay true to the founders, or in this case, stay true to the people who created the 14th Amendment, that they were talking somehow about, you know, corporations being people. I'm sorry, it's not my field, but I just have to have to work that in.
No, absolutely.
It's the most outrageous. And, you know, it's outrageous in any case that interpretation is outrageous, but it is doubly outrageous that people who claim to base their things, that base everything they say on either the intent of the framers or the people who created an amendment or the meaning at the time. I mean, nobody understood at the time that the 14th Amendment was supposed to apply to corporations. I mean,
insult of who it was supposed to apply to.
Yeah,
it's not like it was some bureaucratic law. It was meant to be a human rights law for former slaves.
Yeah,
crazy.
Exactly.
So we're almost out of time, Ray. This has been really great conversation, and I think we have some fodder for sequels to talk about this more. But what final comments would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, really the final comment is to keep organizing, and that there is a majority, that very few people actually want believe in Citizens United, corporate personhood. These are very unpopular positions. They are supported only by an upper echelon elite, and so we have to do something about it. What I'm doing about it personally right now, at this instant, is with this great renewed interest in the Constitution, and ever since Khazir Khan has waived his Constitution and basically thrown down the gauntlet to Donald Trump, showing that he doesn't know anything about the Constitution has become a bestseller. And so right now, I am providing a progressive annotation of the Constitution. Most of the annotated editions of the Constitution are done by right-wing zealots who are saying it's all about personal liberty and government has no place and government regulations suck and all that kind of thing. So I'm giving a progressive counterpart to that, which is going to be put online as an ebook by Vintage shortly before the election, and then a hard copy later. So that's what I'm doing personally. I'm just trying to work on the education aspect of it and showing that that the Constitution, although basically a conservative document, does give us the power to put some real meat into putting the government back in the hands of the people. It has the amendment process, and we can amend the Constitution, but only with a supermajority, and we have to work to get that supermajority.
Well, Ray, excellent. It's been our pleasure to have you with us. I want to remind our audience that you can always get to all of Ray's great material at www.rayraphael.com. And the Ray Raphael is spelled RayRaphael. Again, as Caitlin said, you left a whole lot of fodder for yet another coming sometime soon. So again, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, well, thanks for giving me the chance to talk about it.
Thanks, Ray. Look forward to talking to you about your new work.
And keep up the good work, folks.
Tune in next week when we talk about California's Proposition 59, the overturned Citizens United Act, on the November 2016 ballot with Santa Clara County Move to Amend organizer Ann Wilson and Money Out Voters in co-founder Michelle Stutter. So, folks, join us.
That's it for this edition of Move to Amend Reports. Laura will be back next week. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, and Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, with the assistance of Renee Babcock, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.